from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The Battle of the Books, the Aims and Methods of American Education, this week on Soundings. My guests are Mortimer Adler of the Institute for Philosophical Research and Donald Steadman of the University of North Carolina. Mortimer Adler is a principal architect of the Paideia Project, a blueprint for educational reform. Donald Steadman is Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of North Carolina. In the fall of 1988, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill became the institutional base for the Paideia program. Here is Mortimer Adler.
The Paideia proposal, first of all, is committed to equal educational opportunity for all. That means giving all the children the same quality of schooling for 12 years, with the same curriculum for all, no vocational training, no electives, one foreign language for at least 6 years, manual training for at least 8 years. And in the course of those 12 years, beginning probably in the third, all the students in the school in a seminar once a week, reading books and being questioned. The main educational or pedagogical point in the Paideia program is that the students be actively engaged in learning, not passively engaged by writing notes, listening to lectures, but actively engaged in performing in the various liberal arts of reading, writing, speaking, and listening.
You break it, into what you call three columns, the didactic, coaching, and the Socratic method, talking back and forth among students. Mortimer, let me stop you on a point here. An odd counterpoint to what you're describing about the democracy, the democratic element that you feel is necessary in American education, an odd counterpoint to that is another one of the charges of your critics, that you are an elitist, that you are teaching stuff that's too tough, that's too difficult. Explain that to me.
That's the most absurd charge of all, because since the primary commitment, I'll be repeated again and again, is equal educational opportunity for all, I can hardly be an elitist. Mm-hmm. What they mean is they think that most of the children can't do what we're asking them to do. They're entirely wrong about that.
You think that they can?
In varying degrees. Uh-huh. It is true that a child of greater capacity will acquire more than a child of less capacity, but if each is to receive according to his capacity, you've done what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like we're suffering from a plethora of people with good intentions, and all of them, not necessarily at cross purposes here, but I get that sense. Don Steadman?
Well, there's been a focus on policy reform. Changes in standards for admission for teachers, changes in testing programs in the public schools, attempts to manipulate it as if it were simply a social ecology problem, and a lot of adjustments could be made and something would be right. And then suddenly we have all the interest in the connection between education and economic growth and the global economy, the United States competitiveness in the context of other countries and the rest. And education is the centerpiece there. And educational reform, therefore, is on the minds of a lot more communities than it ever was, including the business and corporate community.
To say that education is a political act, in the 60s it was fashionable to say that teaching was a political act. All right, the educational institution is a political animal. Not whether, but to what extent. How much does that enter into these efforts to reform education?
Oh, a big. The primary action is at the state level. And in that context, cost is a major issue. In North Carolina, to raise teacher salaries across the board 1% cost the state $18 million. Now, in a state where there's a meager surplus from year to year, that's hard to address demands for 10% salary increase for teachers. So we struggle for different ways of doing things, as well as to enhance our teacher corps and to improve the quality of life for teachers through salaries and teaching conditions.
Mortimer Adler, how does money affect the Paideia proposal? You have this noble goal of reforming the aims of education, the impulses that motivate the teachers.
I don't think the educational budget would be any greater with the Paideia reform in place than without it.
Well, are you making assumptions about human nature rather than budgets here?
No. I'm saying if you cut out of the curriculum a lot of things that are very expensive, which we would cut out. When you think that the high schools have many electives, and the number of electives that the high school has involved personnel, cutting down that curriculum, as we cut down very, very radically to its bone, will decrease the cost.
Is it realistic to think that you can do that? I mean, give me some nuts and bolts here. You're talking about eliminating shop and auto mechanics and things like that.
I wasn't saying that, no.
Well, clarify that for me.
Well, the Paideia program, let's go back to the three columns a moment.
All right, the didactic, the coaching, and the Socratic.
The coaching probably is the most expensive because coaching requires a student-teacher ratio of 1 to 6 about. You can't coach 25 at one time.
Well, there are people in American education who would look at the term coaching and say it certainly is an expensive proposition. Athletes and the big university programs.
It's expensive in the classroom just as much.
Sure.
And I think we will solve that problem only when we have program computers for every child. Because in the language arts, which one of the things to be coached, reading, writing, speaking, and listening, the mathematical skills, there are very, very good programs now that would make give the child, each child, individual coach with a coaching teacher in charge of that whole room. That may take some time, but I think it's coming in the next few within this century. The seminar, the ratio of teachers to students during seminar is 1 to 25. 25 is about the size. That's not expensive. In the didactic column, we cut the program down for 12 years now to language and the fine arts, mathematics and natural science, history, geography, and social studies. That's all for 12 years.
So you're not talking necessarily about eliminating things so much as modifying. The key is reform.
I am talking about eliminating. I'm talking, for example, when I say that we should have shop for 8 years or some other form of manual training, it is for intellectual purposes, not for vocational purposes. I'm saying all job training should be limited. All job training should be limited from schools.
Don Steadman?
Well, I wanted to return for a second to why North Carolina.
The Paideia project coming to the university.
Right. We've established here a national center for the Paideia program at the University at Chapel Hill. The University of North Carolina system is a very strong system of public universities, as I think most people would agree. And it has assigned itself a top priority to help strengthen the public schools in North Carolina. As a consequence, we've established a number of statewide programs, including the Principal's Executive Program, which is one which Mortimer Adler visited early on. And through that regular interaction, the principals of the some 2,000 schools in North Carolina became very interested in this as an educational reform and as a way to reconfigure their faculty and their schools to provide a better academic experience for young people in North Carolina. I have literally been astonished that nearly 36 schools in our state, most of them in rural areas, have taken on the Paideia program in its entirety, have begun to train teachers as seminar leaders, have begun to develop materials in reading, in areas of reading they'd never contemplated before, and it's really a revolution.
Does this go to the issue, Mortimer Adler, that you raise about principals being master teachers?
Yes, indeed.
Explain that to me.
We think the principal is the primary factor. That unless the principal is the educational leader of the school, unless he understands Paideia and enlists his teachers in doing it, you haven't got a school. That's why the PEP program is so important. In this state, we have mainly gone after the principals, and won the confidence of the principals and won their support. And all the schools in North Carolina that are successful Paideia schools, beginning, and none of them are complete Paideia schools yet, by far. You have to take some 12 years to make a Paideia school. Are regulated and shall I say, encouraged by their principals.
And the neat thing about it is that it does try to give you some guidance about what to do Monday morning. Most principals in reading Nation at Risk or the Carnegie Task Force report are impressed and agree with many of the proposed reforms, but they don't know what to do Monday morning at their schoolhouse. And the Paideia reform offers that concrete
guidance. About this. You do know about the Wednesday Revolution, don't you?
No, tell me about this.
Well, obviously it's going to take a lot of time to get the whole 12 years is a long. We've only been in the business for 4 years.
The Wednesday Revolution.
Yeah.
Right.
The Wednesday Revolution is the entering wedge of the Paideia program. We say, let me talk about the elementary school first. In the elementary school, There are 30 hours a week. A lot of ground has to be covered according to the state mandates. We say to the principal, find a way of covering that ground, discharging your obligations to the state, in 27 hours. Free up 3 hours on a Wednesday morning.
I see.
And on that Wednesday morning, have one seminar every week for every student in that school. Mm-hmm. And for an hour and a half, then have a writing exercise, some coaching. That opens the door. And when the Wednesday Revolution takes place, it changes the whole character of the school. Amazing. It affects the teachers. The teachers begin to talk to one another about subject matter instead of about the weather and sports and so forth.
Or filling out forms.
Yeah, filling out forms. Yeah. And so the Wednesday Revolution has been a great success at the elementary school. Now, in the high school, we think the English teacher, the history teachers, and the social studies, because they're departmentalized in high schools, can do the same thing in the high school. If the high school principal manages, he finds it more difficult than the elementary school principal, to free up 3 hours a week. 3 hours a week.
Mm-hmm. Don Stedman, Mortimer Adler, let's move to another element of our discussion about American education. Underline a lot of what we're talking about here, the reform of educational policy, the ability of teachers, the abilities of students, is the notion of what? Our inheritance, our literary, historical...
Our intellectual, I prefer to say our intellectual tradition.
All right, our tradition. Yeah. That notion has come under a lot of scrutiny, if not attack, lately. And Mortimer Adler, you happen to be...
I think it's at the heart of that. It began at Stanford. It spread to Duke, at the University of Pennsylvania. I think it's the most ignorant action of the faculties I've ever seen.
Okay, well, now let's you know, we can call some names if we want to, but what are the issues? What are people fighting about?
Let me tell you first. There are five major intellectual traditions in the world. There's one Western tradition, and at least four or five Eastern traditions.
All right.
They're separate.
All right.
They don't have the same body of it. Let's talk only about the West now for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
In the West, until you get to the end of the 18th century, all books have been written by white male Europeans, mm-hmm. no Americans. End of the 18th century. In the 19th century, there are two women, Jane Austen and George Eliot.
Mm-hmm.
There are no blacks. We talk about great books, not influential books.
Okay, and you're going to tell me that a book is great, and I'm going to tell you, no, a book is not great. Are we going to come down to idiosyncratic, subjective judgments?
When in the 1940s, mm-hmm. Bob Hutchins and I at the University of Chicago created a set of great books.
Right.
We picked out 74 authors in 25 centuries. Uh-huh. 74 authors. Of those 74, only about 20 are really great books. Because a great book is a book that can be read again and again and again and again for profit, inexhaustibly readable. There are very few books in 25 centuries like that.
You can say the same thing about Louis L'Amour.
No, you can't.
You can't?
You
aren't there people who reread them?
I doubt it.
Uh-huh.
For profit?
Okay.
Profit?
Uh-huh.
Hardly. I don't think Louis L'Amour is profitable on one reading.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of people who go to sleep reading books, of course, but I'm not talking about that kind of books.
Right.
The notion that a book was not great because it was written by a white male European is utterly absurd.
Are you completely opposed, Mortimer Adler, to the idea of expanding, modifying, making organic this notion of the canon? That is to say, what we look at, how long we look at it, whether we leave it, add something to it?
I would say that the problem is that up to the end of the 19th century, the canon remains untouched.
Mm-hmm.
We have
it hardly started to form itself, if I've got that right. You know, with the rise of the American university systems,
the canon of the great. By the way, the interesting thing about the canon of the great books is that every member of the great books canon,
uh-huh.
that list, has read almost all the other authors that preceded them.
Uh-huh. Well, see, now that's one of the problems of the accusation. This clubbiness.
This
elite clubbiness that people complain about.
Clubbiness. The books that they read were worth reading,
mm-hmm.
and their intellectual tradition is handing on of ideas from generation to generation.
Step back from this notion of a book that's worth reading and tell me how you figure out the criteria for some. You know, you say
I'll
it lasts.
You
say it lasts. It's universal. It can be read for profit.
And it's always contemporary.
Uh-huh.
You never read the great books for as antiquarian objects,
right.
as monuments of antiquity.
Their relevance,
today,
their applicability,
right now.
Okay.
And the relevance, Homer is just as relevant today as when he wrote the Iliad.
Uh-huh.
The Aristotle's Ethics is just as relevant today as when it was written in the 4th century B.C. President Truman said in an autobiographical note that he read read Plutarch every day in his life in the, as the presidency, and then someone asked why, to find out what was going on in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with these people is that they're not interested in great books. They're interested in solving contemporary social problems. And they're totally irrelevant. Their conversation about great books is totally irrelevant to the canon entirely.
Let me stop you for a moment, Mortimer Adler. Are you telling me that it is impossible, that it is undesirable to admit works into the canon by the so-called minorities, the people who
haven't written great books? When they write a great book, it'll be put in the canon.
All right, and that is, and whose decision is that?
The general public.
Mm-hmm.
I should not forget to add that in the reading list, particularly with elementary school children, we read Martin Luther King's Letter from a Birmingham Jail, we read Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, and there are other books by both blacks and women in the list. But they're not there because they're written by blacks or women. They're written by human beings dealing with important problems. They happen to be, in the 20th century, they happen to be blacks and women, but that's not the reason why they're there. We're not representing classes. We're not politicizing this thing at all. We would never will do that.
Don Stedman.
Let me just be an innocent bystander for a second.
Sure.
And tell you that this conversation, this type of conversation that we're just now having, is a whole new, fresh kind of debate in the context of education reform in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
This kind and level of debate about conflict of ideas has been introduced into the reform movement of the public schools by the Padilla program. I mean, 5 years ago, we were arguing about whether it was 170 hours a week or 180 hours a week the kids ought to go to school.
By the way, Alan Mortimer.
Now we're arguing about ideas, and that's the value. Two major things have happened.
Substance
uh-huh. and debate uh-huh. about substantial curricular academic issues in the public schools. And the other is that high school teachers and college teachers are talking together again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That great schism has been just evaporated by the introduction of this reform.
Well, we're trying to do something about that here at the Humanities
valuable.
Center. Mortimer Adler.
You know, the great book started at Columbia. Alan Bloom knows nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very bad book indeed. I don't recommend that book at all.
Strong words.
A very bad book.
Mm-hmm.
Erskine created the first great books course in Columbia in 1921. He made a list of about 57 books that's been expanded since then. The St. John's, when we created St. John's College in 1937, the list expanded to about 127 authors, including the Erskine list was very weak on science and mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
The St. John's list, and by the way, it's at St. John's College, it's the only college in the country where for 4 years they read the great books, have two seminars a week. That list has stood the test for 50 years. Of teaching in that college. The Paideia program, the third book we wrote, contains as an appendix a list of 250 books graded from third grade up to the 12th grade,
mm-hmm.
as well as in college. That the important thing about the list is this. In that list, there are books of varying degrees of greatness. The ideal of greatness is, as I say, the indefinite rereadability. Plutarch's the kind of book that you read again and again and again. Montaigne's essays, again and again and again. Shakespeare's plays, Dante's Divine Comedy. I mean, the fact that they were written, at the time they were written by white European males is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And the people...
Not a conspiracy.
It'd be wonderful if women could have written in the 13th century,
mm-hmm.
but they couldn't have written in the 13th century.
Well, some of the scholars today, Mortimer Adler, are telling us that, in fact, women did write in the 13th century, and those things are now being discovered and brought to light, and they're saying they deserve attention, maybe not equal attention, maybe in time, you know, these things will rise to the top, that is to say, with academic as well as popular audiences. And you feel strongly in the other direction.
Well, when I see the book, I'll let you know.
Don Stedman, let me follow up a point that Mortimer Adler has raised. That is to say, nervousness in the schools. What's going to get eliminated? What's going to stay? And let's put the term vocational education on the table.
Well, the vocational education people are a little bit concerned that the Padilla program is an elitist approach to education, which it is not. And that it will somehow push them out of the junior and senior high schools at a time when they're trying to become a more important component of secondary education. I don't think this is a fair observation to make for this reason. Padea program does not resent or resist vocationalism. What it does is to provide students with critical thinking skills and an approach to knowledge and a flexibility and an understanding of knowledge and language and self that's necessary to be an effective worker or professional person or a teacher or anything to lead a happy life.
Doesn't necessarily make a lot of assumptions about the ends of education, but it does make some assumptions about the means, about what happens and where you go.
In a very practical sense, if you look at surveys of employers, what they want is people who can read, write, and think critically. Yeah. They don't care whether they're fully trained to turn hamburgers or to fix DC-9s or whatever it is. But they want thinking, understanding, knowledgeable people.
Mortimer Adler?
The three stated objectives of the Paideia proposal are to enable each child to earn a living, prepare a child for competence and performance of his duties as a citizen of this republic, and three, to go on learning after leaving school and lead a rich human life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are the three objectives of schooling. And certainly earning a living is one of them. But as Don says a moment ago, that reading and writing are much more important than lathe work and carpentry and learning a living in terms of the kind of high-tech economy we now have. About 5 years ago, AT&T, before it was disbanded, reported that they had to interview 15 high school graduates to find one who could read and write well enough to be a telephone operator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very sad thing.
That's depressing. Don Steadman from the University of North Carolina, Mortimer Adler from the Paideia Project. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What do you see on the horizon for American education? Are you optimistic? Mortimer, you're an inveterate optimist. I realize that's a sort of an unfair question. But tell me, are you realistically optimistic about educational reform in this country?
Yes, but only in the long term, not immediately.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the address I'm going to give tonight as my inaugural lecture, says reforming education cannot be a quick fix. I think we have a chance in the long run, sometime in the next century, to get this country with a purely democratic system of schooling and with the Paideia program installed.
Apart from all of this talk about the canon and what gets read and what doesn't get read, is there a necessary connection between your goals with Paideia and this discussion that's going on in the academy today?
I think the discussion going on in the academy is totally irrelevant to Paideia. Mm-hmm. They can go on talking that way for as long as they want to. It has nothing to do with Paideia. Paideia involves the choice of a number of good books, good or great, and the goodness or greatness is that they're discussable. That they contain ideas and issues worth discussing.
Uh-huh.
That canon is very large indeed.
You're going to tell me that people like Ralph Ellison and Willy Soyinka and are non-white people of color who are thinkers and writers, they don't have things to say that are worth talking about?
The question is whether or not the books they've written contain any novelty in the ideas that it's discussing.
Uh-huh. And you're saying that
as far as we know, they don't to date, yes.
All right. Don Steadman?
Well, I think for me, the practical problem is whether or not we will let the schools perform their function at the community level as educational organizations.
Hmm.
If we keep piling on non-academic, non-educational tasks to solve problems that are more properly solved elsewhere in the community, then the school will not have a chance.
In general terms, Don Steadman, can we point a finger and say, here are some villains who need to be identified? Again, you know, the problem of good intentions, that sort of thing. Are we talking about the educationists? Are we talking about the teachers? What, the expectations of the parents? Be concrete for me.
Well, I think in one way, the communities have identified the school as places where children are, And if they have a problem that they view to be a social problem in their community, whether it's AIDS or a health problem or whether it's desegregation or whether it's housing, they tend to use the school as a context in which to play that out.
Mm-hmm.
And
so we're talking about parental abdication, after
well,
a fashion.
Well, in a sense. And I think one of the important issues before us in the future for PDEA or anything else is whether families can continue to make an investment in education in their children, to develop and maintain an achievement motivation for themselves and their mm-hmm. children. And
Mortimer Adler.
Unless the home supports the school can't succeed. The parents must cooperate with the school. The best schools in the United States are those that have enlisted the parents in the PIDEA program.
Mm-hmm.
In these two schools, these two ghetto schools in Chicago that I'm talking about, we talk to the parents, we get the parents in seminars. The parents must understand what we're doing with the children and be for it. Be happily engaged in it themselves.
Well, to be perfectly honest, Mortimer, it sounds to me like that would be more difficult, getting the parents in a ghetto school
yes.
involved than the kids themselves. And you're saying it works.
We've done it. We've done it in these two, this Hispanic school and this black school in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
In the two worst ghettos in Chicago. And succeeded.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about the aims and methods of American education. My guests were Mortimer Adler of the Institute for Philosophical Research and Donald Stedman of the University of North Carolina. Next week on Soundings, my guests will be Barbara Herrnstein-Smith of Duke University and Daryl Gless of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 434. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The fourth week in January marks an anniversary for the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill in California in 1848. The American and English writers Edith Wharton and Virginia Woolf were born during the last week in January, Wharton in 1862, Woolf in 1882. The last week in January marks an anniversary for the Great Seal of the United States, authorized by Congress in 1782. Finally, the last week in January is the anniversary of the Vietnam War ceasefire, signed at Paris in 1973. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Battle of the Books, this week on Soundings. Listen for Mortimer Adler and Donald Stedman. Mortimer Adler is a principal architect of the PIDEA Project, a blueprint for the reform of American education. Donald Stedman is Associate Academic Vice President of the University of North Carolina System. What and how should American youngsters learn? The Battle of the Books, Part 1. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.